recording. So here we are back at the Beit Midrash, and we're involved in the Masechet Ta'anit. And we learned through the first daf. So we could say we're officially through the first daf of our Masechet. Yishar koach.
That's an accomplishment. And so,
thank you. You're welcome. It's taken us a couple of sessions, but we started out understanding that we were going to insert a liturgical passage, a line in our tefillah about recognizing God's power to send rain and winds, and it's going to be at a certain time. And last we were talking, we were recognizing that the line itself in tefillah recognized not only God's power of making rain and causing precipitation to fall, but there were other powers that were mentioned in terms of a Gaudic Midrashic passage that said God has a couple of keys on the ring in his hands, and that those kinds of powers God has that somewhat are involved in nature, they're understandable, and we still have to recognize them as miracles, and maybe that's what the liturgy is there for, so that we can still harness this kind of awe and wonder when it comes to that which comes on a routine pattern in nature. Yet we have to stop ourselves and say, incredible! This is a power of God's force in creation, or God's being in creation, and also something to the great mystery, there's something to also recognizing the power God has over one of the great mysteries of life, and that is what happens in the next world. What happens in the land of souls, if it's not next in terms of temporal reality? What is it about our being alive and embodied in this world? We say, God, you will one day revive the dead, or revive the soul, whatever that means. And we have an idea of what that looks like only by way of tradition. But we recognize God as the grantor of life that way. Childbirth and resurrection of the dead were the two other keys on the ring. You grant life, at least the life embodied that we have and we understand and we appreciate, and you will one day in the future restore the soul. We did not go into great depth about resurrection and the vision of what will happen. I think that there's probably a place that it's going to come back within the Masechta, and maybe we'll take a deeper look at Ezekiel's vision of the dry bones and what it meant to our ancestors, what it could mean to us in terms of thinking about renewed sense of vigor in life versus an actual vision of what's going to happen in the future. But that's to say that there's an interesting connection vis-a-vis the beginning tefillah of Gvurot Geshamim, the powers that God has in terms of rain and precipitation and moisture and making lush the world, and this dry bone scenario and how it's then brought back with vitality. Right, that the lushness of the rebirth of the rainy season and all that grants is kind of like this life-affirming power God's going to have in the world of souls and resurrection of the dead, right? And if you take it that way, then there's a certain resurrection happening with water itself. Water, in a certain way, is the life-giver, as God is the life-giver to souls, water is the life-giver to nature, water is the life-giver to the human beings in this embodiment that we have and this world that we know. And therefore, water becomes a natural third key. Right? The power of rain becomes a natural third key on the ring of God's great powers. And push that further, the rabbis want to make sure that we understand in temple worship, and this is really now getting to the detail of where the last part of the second page of Gemara leaves off, they want to make sure that we understand that ritually, in the temple, during Sukkot, we not only have a liturgy that we add, a line of liturgy that we add to our prayers, but there's actual pouring out of water as part of the celebration of Sukkot. It's water libations, nisuch hamayim. And so they're using the opportunity to talk about the way we pray now, but they're also using it as an opportunity to talk about what ritual looked like in the temple, which is a feature in and of itself of Talmudic literature, because the rabbis like to recapture pictures of what ritual life was all about in the temple during temple times, and somehow link us, right? This is the last words we said last class, link us to our ancestors' worship in the temple and get a sense that we're narrating the continuing story of the Jewish people and how we worship God in what we do now. So this debate about when we start to say this line in our prayers about recognizing God's power, that's somehow, quote-unquote, the way we recognize God's power instead of what? The nisuch hamayim, the pouring out of water with the offerings during the holiday of Sukkot.
Simchat Beit HaShoeva.
So, right. So Simchat Beit HaShoeva, which is the joy of water pouring, is not necessarily in modern times.
It was at that time, it was in Sukkot.
Right. In modern times. We even have some communities who keep some Simchat Beit HaShoeva celebration, the joy of the water libations. But it's more a celebration in the sukkah and during the chag, and not the actual libation part, because we're not doing the actual work of the temple anymore. Our prayers have, in a certain way, replaced all of that, right? Though they have a nice party and call it Simchat Beit HaShoeva. Our determining that the water libations, though they were not explicitly mentioned in the Torah, are in fact, is as a practice, in fact, Torah base, is where we left off. Discovering through exegesis and hermeneutics, or midrash halakha in a certain way, the kind of reading practice of our text, of our sacred text, in order to draw out of our text whether or not this practice is found in the Torah, even though it's not explicitly stated in the Torah that you should do this, because it's not explicitly stated in the Torah anywhere that you should actually have a water libation. Right? We know that there's wine libation mentioned, but we don't have the water libation mentioned. They find, though, remember, the mem of the word mayim, which is water, the yud of the word mayim, and the final mem of the word mayim, in three words, in three different parts of verses that then helps them derive from this set of words that, of course, we would call nisuch hamayim, the pouring out of waters, water libation, deoraita. It's Torah-based. Now you may ask, so why do I need to go through that kind of work to find verses to make any mitzvah connected to Torah verses? Now you may not ask that because you've been around the Beit Midrash long enough to know. That's what gives it real sanctity in terms of one way of thinking of the rabbis. If I can prove a mitzvah has verses from which I learn that mitzvah, even if it doesn't say it explicitly and I have it as what's called either an asmachta, the basis for that practice, or I have it as a svar that I've reasoned it from these verses, then I have at the core of that experience of the mitzvah the commandment from Torah that allows me to, no questions asked, include that ritual as part of what I do in the temple. What I said last time was that kind of reasoning is very rabbinic, and I imagine to the Kohanim, the Sadducees versus the Pharisees now, if you want to take the proto groups to the rabbis and the temple priests, or the temple priests group, you could always call the Tzadukim. They had a group. They had practices in the temple. Much of the practice in the temple was very straightforward in terms of learning the laws that they needed to practice right from the Torah. And they might have had one or another practices that grew out of their own understanding of sacred scripture Levitical passages, passages in Numbers regarding sacrifices. And one of those practices that they derived, perhaps, was this practice of Nisuch HaMayim. Did the rabbis, you know, was it the chicken or the egg? Did the rabbis then see that they were doing this and say, oh, we have the verses for it, and now we'll learn the Nisuch HaMayim from these verses that we can see somehow connect to the practices during Sukkot? Or was it the actual priests who both had a respect for the worship and the work of the temple and the verses that guided them, and the rabbis affirm that by putting it in the Gemara? That's a historical question I can't really answer. We can't really answer. Right? Understand the two possibilities, the two different theories? In other words, is it the rabbis who come up with the drush and then said this is obviously what they did and they're projecting that onto the Kohanim? Or did the Kohanim have the practice they had learned from the text, the rabbis affirm it by including it in the Gemara? I can't answer the question. But either which way, the important piece is the narrative connection and the connectivity between the rabbinic culture and the Kohenic culture in this regard, and the importance of water that comes into focus during this holiday particularly.
So I'm wondering, though, that they're going to go into a period with not much water. Don't we assume that that's why we're doing this prayer, is because it's going to be more scarce? They must have had enough water to spill out for no reason.
Actually, it's starting. Actually, it's the opposite in this case.
Oh, because...
They're going to recognize that it's God's power that brings this season of rain.
Right. Okay, so they're beginning the rainy season.
Yeah.
So then they can spill out water because they're going to get more. So that's what I wanted to make,
yeah,
the connection of being almost wasteful with water. So they've had enough left over that they can spill it out before the rain starts again. Is that true?
That could be. By the way, the spilling part, yes, so I see your reasoning, and I think it's nice to think, oh, the only reason why we could actually pour this out right now and that we don't waste it otherwise, if we want to call it waste, is...
Well, if you are dying without water, and there's a drought, then you're not going to be adding this to your libations, because you can do wine.
That would be throwing it in God's face and saying, where are you? We need water. Here, we are saying, we so appreciate your power of making rain and providing water. Let us pour some out. And what's interesting about it is it's not just massive amounts of water poured out, but there's special kind of basins, and they have certain kinds of spigots that release a trickle of water on the altar, and it sits next to this other one that is over here with wine. And if you can imagine, you've seen the beautiful kind of coffee urns and water urns that sit, and you go like this, or you flick the little switch, and how it can move so slow, really. It just trickles, right? There's no, like, it's not a hard or fast pour.
I'm imagining,
right?
You know.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm imagining water, you know, jugs,
right,
or something.
Splashed and
yeah.
this and that. So there seems to be some of that in the Mishnah with Beit Simchat Beit HaShoevah, the joy of the water festival of sorts. But there's a very kind of, I don't want to say dainty, but there's a careful way of making these libations happen in a way that we're not thinking about, that we wouldn't think about.
Do you know that because there are descriptions about,
yes,
how it's done?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, the Temple Institute in Jerusalem,
right,
has set up a, if you will, a model ritual,
right,
based on some of this. And there are some wonderful pictures of this ritual. So, let me see if I can bring them at some point. Barry?
So I was under the impression when we were at the Western Wall that, in fact, they needed enormous amounts of water for the sacrifices and dealing with cleaning up. If you think about how many animals were sacrificed and what it means to be sacrificed,
the bloody
according
mess
to, is, you know, pizza, you can imagine just how much water was needed to clean things up.
If they cleaned up.
What?
They might not clean it up, only by the Mizbeach.
No, well, again, the way it was explained to me was that there was a very elaborate system for bringing the water to the temple for just that reason.
No doubt about it, but they were not libations.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking about libation. I'm saying separate.
There is,
from
there's the water channels and then the wells that are dug. We know from Chizkiyahu's water tunnels that to get water into Jerusalem, it was redirected and they could bring it up from within. These kinds of practices of use of water towards cleanliness of the Beit HaMikdash for sure had to be used, but by way of an actual libation, which is different.
Yeah.
And ritual libation.
But I was just saying
they're not learning that from Torah. They're naturally doing that.
I'm just saying that the practical reality was that they were used to having or knew that they needed an enormous amount of water for that other purpose, you know, separate from whatever they did.
Yeah. I may have copied it and put it in earlier today. This very picture.
And the mikvahs also, though, there was the whole trickled water thing, right?
I mean, in the mikvahs had to be maim chayim, had to be natural waters. Most of it had to be, not drawn. And, yeah, those definitely...
You used to have a lot of mikvahs around the temple.
Correct. And we found more. Ah, look.
Interesting. I have no
idea. Reenactment of the ancient water libation ritual revives part of temple service. I wasn't going to get into it, but since you asked, I don't have more than one copy of color, so I saved us the ink. But you see that they have special pitchers, and they have these special pitchers, and then they bring the pitchers of water, and they bring it to, and this one's, I think, big enough picture to describe what I was telling you before. So you see this urn of sorts? This is the bottom of the urn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And here is a little spout. Mm-hmm. And it's making for almost like a little trickle of a stream of water onto the altar. I'll pass this around so you can see. So when we're talking about these, you're talking about ceremonies and fun and celebration. When it came to the water, Simchat Beit HaShoeva, you had, as I described, fire juggling and people juggling and the sages flipping and dancing. And I think I told you the Talmud said, you know, not everybody should get that full of cheer. You know, only these folks who were known as the sages. But when they carried the water in, they celebrated, and they had the vessel of water. So the vessel's very, very elegant, and the actual urn. So take a look. They took from the pool that was near Jerusalem.
Okay.
So I'll pass that around. Yeah.
It seems that from what you're describing, there's a complexity between being grateful to have the source of water and abundance of water, and yet treat it as holy, and therefore using just a trickle of it, because there is a balance where not have water, but we're also grateful because we have it in abundance.
Right. So that balance, yeah, right. That's a very good way to talk about the balance. And so we're also grateful if it's sent in the right ways, right, at the right times.
Right.
And it's not going to impede. Mind you, we thought that some of our prayers might be so effective that we delayed saying them. Remember, that was part of the first daf of the Gemara. You know, let the pilgrims get home and then start saying it. And we don't want it to be dangerous and be too wintry. And we don't want the winds to be too blustery.
And it's one Esrei. We ask for water at a certain period and at a certain time we don't.
Right, exactly. And by the way, we're not really asking for water. Again, the notion was you were recognizing God's power, and then we ask for water in Barich. So just by way of, yes, you're right, we are asking for water, but we're doing that in the blessing of Barich, and not here where we're recognizing God's power of it in Atagi Borlel Amadonai. You are the hero and you have power. Let's get into some text now. We've just described the Nisuch HaMayim, and that picture's going around and you can see it. And the Gemara on Daf Gimel, now, we're going to go to 3A1. We're going to look and see that somebody has a different idea about a verse, that I don't have to learn it from this Mem Yud Mem recipe that you told me about on the bottom of page 2b, where I had different words that had extra letters. I have a different Breita, Breita being the text from the Tanaitic age. So I'm at 3a1 on the left-hand column, in the middle of the left-hand column, nearly the middle, called the Gemara cites another scriptural source for the water libations. Okay, so it says Tanya. It's taught in a Breita. Rabbi Natan says, Bakodesh hasech nesech shechar ladonai. Scripture states the following: on the holy altar, pour a libation of intoxicating beverage to God. So this is a verse that's talking about your tamid offering, the everyday offering. And where I have a lesson about one korban, I can learn for other korbanot as well. I can learn for other offerings as well. And so I see that the verse is going to be used. And how is it going to be? B'shnei nisuchin hakatuv medaber. That's talking about two kinds of rituals that we do. Echad nisuch hamayim, one is the libation of water, ve'echad nisuch hayayin, and the other is the libation of wine. The Gemara asks the question. You're doing a ritual that seems not to be in the Torah, is the force of the question.
Yeah.
Philosophically, again, the question is about ritual studies, or is a ritual studies question in terms of our Judaism. If it's really not in the Torah and it's rabbinic reasoning, are you going to accept that this is now an official part of our tradition? Or beyond that? If it doesn't say it in the Torah, and the rabbis have inherited the tradition from the Kohanim, and somehow it's going to make for an impact within our prayer system, even if we don't do the same libation, but it's going to show up in a way in our liturgy, meaning they did the pouring out of the waters and we're going to mention the power of waters and we're going to ask for rain at the right time. Do I accept it if it's not written clearly in the Torah? So it's sometimes
if it
like...
comes from the Kohanim, does that mean it comes from Aaron?
Ah, so really interesting question. Let's put it in the parking lot for a minute. Do we have a tradition about Aaron being a teacher of anything that we totally accept, like we are going to accept certain traditions from Moses?
Right.
Let's leave it over here. But right now, it didn't mention Aaron.
But it mentioned Kohanim.
But it didn't even really mention Kohanim. I am suggesting, in a question that's beyond the page of Gemara, that this is what the Gemara is really asking. Which for us, in our time, is the question, how and when do we accept a tradition? A tradition. What are the kind of anchors we feel we need when it comes to tradition in our lives? Now, some of them can be the same anchors that Chazal, that the rabbis of the Talmudic age, put into play. Some of them will be learned over millennia, and so we have to understand, what are the ones that are closest to what the rabbis were okay with versus what I've now discovered over time?
So the Pesach Seder, we don't do what it says in the Torah. We follow what's in the Mishnah.
Right. There we go. So when are we ready to accept that the Torah has a presentation of a certain kind of ritual and it no longer holds because of either time or the fact that Chazal have it? And do you believe that what Chazal revealed in the Mishnah, is it all connected to that Sinai experience back when we say it was given?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you not? And do you accept it otherwise that way? Well, so on a ritual studies level, again, here's the Gemara working that out. Do I need to understand that this Pasuk gave me the mitzvah to put the wine and the water to work in the Beit HaMikdash? Well, Ema Tarvaihu Dechamra, the Gemara says, no, you can't say that one is water and one is wine. One could say, or one should read the verse, that both of the libations alluded to are of wine. What do we say wine was the symbol for, and why is it important to have this wine accompany the natural beasts or the natural offering you're bringing? Because wine represents the toil of human beings with the products of God's nature that can only grow with the right amount of heavenly chen, heavenly grace. A grape, a vine, but then we have to do something to that grape from the vine in order to make the wine. And water, we don't need to do very much with, if anything at all, except collect it in its pure form. It's the straightforward, simplest kind of basic ingredient of the world that we then bring to the altar. Maybe it's only the complex animal system and the complexity of the wine and the mix of the recipe of the bread. I don't just put flour there like this. I make a mincha offering with some ingredients and some oil. Well, I learned, though, that it's both water and wine, and the Gemara says, no, it's got to be both wine, and then the Gemara answers, im kain, if so, that both libations are of wine. Lichtov kra o hasech hasech o nasech nesech. If it was just wine, I would have expected the verse's grammar to be that the exact use of the root would be doubled. There would be a doubling of the exact use of the root. Either nasech nesech, nun samechaf, nun samechaf, or hey samechaf, hey samechaf. That's not the, by the way, grammar, what do we know? We know that it's from the same root anyhow. Because hasech, if you look at it, there's a little dagesh, see the dot inside the samech? For those who are interested in grammar.
Yeah.
That is the fallen nun. And so probably the nun of nasech is in there, if you will. And the hasech, the hey, is a grammatical form of like a he-feel verb, a causative verb form. And therefore, I am talking about the same root. But what the Talmudic sages are saying at this point is that I would have expected hasech, hasech, or nasech, nesech. I would not have expected the kind of combination that I got in the verse, which is hasech, nesech. One with a hey and one with a nun. And therefore, since one is with a hey and one was with a nun, shamata mina, you learn from it that chad demayev, chad dechamra. One is water and one is wine. And thusly, I'm left with water and wine. Now tell me.
I didn't really get that.
Okay, let's go.
Just mixing two different.
Let's go back. There's one verse.
Together, I don't.
There's one verse. There's one verse. There's one verse.
Right.
And we know we have to do wine libations, but it has two different uses, hasech and nesech. I would have expected. Why would you expect that it would have used the same one twice?
Yeah.
Because that's the hermeneutical hava amina. That's the proposition that the rabbis created. Is there a real explanation as to why, in fact, you need a duplication of the root in either of those two forms? That's not here. But what we have to realize is that hermeneutical movement or hermeneutical reading to take from verses in order to learn how we then bring that to the level of bitsua, action in the world and ritual in the world, that is a value in and of itself.
No, I understand that. I just
so
is there a specific hermeneutical principle at play other than just noticing every letter?
So good question, because what Dale's referring to is that sometimes we have lists of hermeneutical principles in the ancient world, the most famous being Rabbi Yishmael's 13 principles. We have ways of reading scripture that allow us to learn out what the meaning of a word is or the law that's being derived really should be, and we abide by those in certain circles if we come from the same, say, rabbinic school. We also have accepted forms of midrashic reading, midrash halakha, that Professor David Weiss-Halivni has discussed before as being perhaps even the earliest strata of how we learn what Jewish law really is all about, and it's both rabbinic, proto-rabbinic, and even there a Kohenic strata in there, which is why I can even purport that, you know, which came first, again, the rabbinic read of the verses and then the practice, or the Kohenic read of the verses and then the rabbis affirming it. That said, at its core, and maybe we're scratching at this, and if someone wants to challenge it a little bit even more straight on, does it really make sense to derive our practice as a group who wants to honor God and honor the liturgical kind of hope that we are affirming God's power? Does it make sense that we're either finding the word mayim in this mem, in that yud, in that mem, or in the way that this word is different than that word? Does it feel right? Is that a way to really truly affirm what we are to learn to do from our Torah?
Well, using two words to mean the same thing, we have the same principle in American law. That if there's two words that are being applied, and they're two different words, then the legislature must have meant two different things. The exact same thing is not the mem yud mem business, but this
yeah, but aster, the first aster is the function, and neser is the Torah, it's the description of what you do. It's the same root, but it's two different functionality. I'm not taking his position on that. It's like saying, Ave Mayim. Ave is the aser, and Mayim is the water.
I don't know enough to answer.
It's saying cause to pour out the actual offering of the libration. I understand. So there's no position to take or not to take. It is that if I wanted to learn...
The words are the same thing, I think, is what you're saying. And he's saying the two words are not the same thing.
Correct.
One is the functionality and one is the...
But it's about the roots, Ron. It's about the roots more than it is about the actual...
The root is the same root.
Right, exactly. So the notion is it would have been less causative and the direct object thereof, less, you know, the verb to pour out and then the actual offering itself as indirect object of what you are pouring out. It would have been two versions of one of those, pour out, or the offering. That aside, if they use it twice in American law and there are two things to learn and we're still doing that, the same question I'm asking applies. Is that a way to learn law?
Classic claim construction.
Is that at the core, if we were legal philosophers, right? If we go back and now we accept the fact that this was a holy word game, as I've described it by Professor Heinemann standards, we've described that before. We appreciate that as Jews. We live by that. Three times are mentioned, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. Therefore, the three repetitions must mean something, and therefore, it doesn't just mean cook the word. It means don't mix the milk and meat. Don't sell and don't eat.
No.
So you have three, you know, the same verb at the core, but you have three different, you know, kind of laws that you derive. That's early Midrash Halakha as well. That one sounds a little smarter, right, because it's pretty straightforward and it deals with something that we have to do all the time vis-a-vis our admixture of milk and meat. But, you know, when it comes to this kind of exploration and the notion that philosophically, liturgically, we want to get to recognizing God's power, and we might want to spill some water in addition to wine. I'm pushing the question: why do we need verses to tell us that when I have another potential way of learning that too? This is what the Gemara is going to basically ask us right now. The Gemara, in and of itself, which is not normally read this way, but I'm reading it for us within a framework of the very deep polemic the Gemara is dealing with. If you read Professor Weiss-Halivni, if you read Dr. Christine Hayes, who will be here this year for our Lucy lecture, who's an expert in rabbinic text, if you look at some of what's really going on here, the next question we're about to get in the Gemara's Lashon, in the Gemara's language, in the rabbinic debate going on any given page of Gemara is, do I need that kind of reading out of verses when I have a different system of telling you about a tradition and where it comes from at my disposal? And what is that other system that I have at my disposal? It's Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. This is law given to Moses on Sinai. I don't need to go and pull the mem and pull the yud and pull the mem. And even though it sounds maybe more legally reasonable to assert one is different than the other, if I have these two words, and therefore your argument seems specious because you would have expected the same thing, and then you could have said wine and water. Why don't you just say the fact that they're so different gives me more power to say that they're two different kinds of offerings, wine and water. Right? But do I even really need to be in the weeds of those verses at all? And at the core of that discussion, now that I'm, you know, presented the details, do I need to read the verses? Can't I use this framework and this doctrine called Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai, the law given to Moses at Sinai? The real question on the rabbinic text level is, what do I really feel about every time in all the different places in the Gemara that it seems like rabbinic culture is trying to, from verses, really derive what I know is standard Jewish practice? What is it about that move that I need to do that pretty consistently? And who does it more often than the other? Did the Tanaim, the Amoraim are asking, the rabbis of the Talmudic era who are looking at the Mishnaic era, where there was a lot of use of these hermeneutic principles and a lot of exegesis and a lot of looking at texts as the base and a lot of carrying that tradition forward among colleagues over here, these colleagues over here are saying, sometimes it seems like you guys are doing serious hermeneutical jumping jacks when we know that that is Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. Tradition. That's what it is.
That could suggest that there was a challenge. That there was a challenge to the practice, and there was a debate as whether it was halacha whether it was deraita. And they're saying, here's an argument that proves the point.
I like that. That's exactly the direction I'm trying to have us think a little bit about, with being totally respectful for the fact that this is the real, again, we did this with Arve Pesachim. This is the committee work, right? Is this something we're going to continue? Is this something we're going to legitimize as having been done in the Beit HaMikdash, and we're going to say tefillot about water, just like they had something going on about water? Am I Torah okay here? Right? And maybe someone was saying, no, let's challenge that. And the way to answer the challenge is either to prove that it's affirmatively d'oraita, as you mentioned, a Torah law. Here are the verses to prove it, which, by the way, if I prove it like this, it's hard for me to say within the system of d'oraita and d'rabbanan, which is a two kinds of levels of mitzvah that the rabbinic system creates, right? That it's rabbinic and Torah-itic, and that the Torah-itic are first level, the rabbinic second level, the Torah law trumps the rabbinic law in certain cases. I have to be more careful about my Torah-itic law than I do about my d'rabbanan law in many ways. Not, I'm going to be careful with everything, but it might not be d'oraita. It might be that I found an asmachta, I found an anchor, I found a firm ground in the Torah to reason this through, a savara. So I don't know that I get a right to status out of this, but I've answered the challenge in your construct. I've answered the challenge. And if I want to answer the challenge in a different way, which we're about to read inside, that it's halacha l'moshe m'Sinai, that's a very different emotional place. It's a very different approach to what I need in terms of the question of what's the authority behind this practice? What's the authority of this narrative? And the fact that we still or do this now, they did that, and we are going to continue that into the future.
If it's Moshe from Sinai, don't you have the obligation to have evidence of it being unbroken from then till now?
You do, but the way they use the term, it's unbroken, simply put.
But if someone were to find a break,
right?
I mean, like, you know, I'm thinking of Kelleck when the loss of the knowing exactly what the color was, that stopped it, because even though there was a long tradition, if the tradition is not continuous,
yeah,
then there's anxiety as to whether or not it's actually still being
written. Right, and that was even written explicitly in Torah.
Right.
And we didn't have... That's a little bit... I'll just say there's a maishane. There's a what's different about this and that going on here, because in that sense, losing the ability to identify the particular snail from which the dye came and then the chemical recipe about how to make it in the right hue is a little different than oppositely the Torah the Moshe Sinai argumentation about some other issues where, quite oppositely, science as it is helping us discover a little bit more accurately about some of the Jewish laws that limit our use, let's say, of a certain substance or a certain animal based on what we might call quote-unquote bad science, really, really takes us the opposite direction. So, yes and,
okay.
There's just a little bit of a difference. Judy.
I can't help but wonder, and I mean, I'm not very good at historical knowledge, but I wonder whether there wasn't some pressure when you take something that was oral law for very, very long, you know, for centuries. And when you go to write it down, I think there may be some inherent pressure to make sure you're getting it right, because it's going to be a lot harder to let it adjust and move over time after that.
I think you're absolutely onto it in terms of now thinking about it in the framework of oral law and oral culture.
Exactly.
These are some of the first times that they are writing them down. And it's some of the first times that they're doing the detective work in a kind of backwards engineering kind of way to find where the anchors really are. And some of them are very clear and explicit. But sometimes I come up against a ritual that really doesn't have a direct commandment.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's partly... Even though there is no direct commandment, when you go to write something down, if you can find something that is at least consistent with what you believe the practice to be, you feel better about it.
Right, and I think part of this is about feeling better. And therefore, there's a lot of emotion in these texts that sometimes seem to us like hermeneutical machinations within rabbinic culture. And I want us to tap into that emotion. I want to feel right and good that I'm participating in a way that is from my Torah. The rabbis want us to have allegiance to this Torah. Not that we didn't have allegiance before, but now we have even more allegiance to this definitive culture that's being created by the rabbis. And they are finding that sometimes they have the direct instruction, sometimes they have to find the verses that allow for them to create the legislation that's necessary for the time. And sometimes they're going to need to use this kind of recognition that perhaps that was the oral tradition and the way it was practiced, and we ought to accept more often that the explanation is not from what looks like a reflection of the hermeneutics that were done pre-temple destruction in the first part of the Tanaitic era, but that there was a, even if there was some break in the chain, we can recapture that chain, a la Barry, your question about the breaks in the chains, and say, I know that the great, let's say, zugot, the pairs of proto-rabbanim that are mentioned throughout, they kept this tradition alive, and it was in that path of Moses, Joshua, elders, prophets, all the way through this living chain of tradition. And therefore, I could say halacha l'moshe m'sinai. Not to say that the verses sometimes also don't have the same force of oral history and the core oral history of the culture of ritual that we created. It could be as old and feel as good for those who really needed the verses versus the connection to Moses. But the Gemara is going to move from these two workouts with finding the word mayim, mem yud mem, and having found now the potential that these two exist because of the verse, hasech nesech, and we're going to move to the bottom side of 3A1, the right-hand column now, and go into this section that deals with this halacha l'moshe m'sinai aspect of the Talmud. The Gemara is going to arrive at the conclusion regarding the authorship of the Mishnah. That's less important to me right now than the actual limud here, the words of the limud. Ela Rabbi Yehoshua, the author of the Mishnah is Rabbi Yehoshua. There was some interest in who was really the author of the Mishnah, although Rabbi Yehoshua holds that we do not mention the powers of rain until the eighth day. He concedes that the water libations are performed earlier. V'nisuch ha-mayim kol shiva hilchata gemirei or gemirei la. Because it is a law that's been received in the chain of tradition from Sinai. And here we hear the notion of hilchata gemirei la. It was really taught very, very succinctly, particularly that it was in the tradition from Sinai. The water libation was done all 7 days. De'ama Rabbi Ami Ama Rabbi Yochanan. For Rabbi Ami said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Nechunya Ish Bikat Beit Chortan, who said in the name of Rabbi Nechunya, the resident of the valley of Beit Chortan. Already you stack up some names here too, and you get a sense that this is really a chain of tradition, right? Esther Nitiot, the ruling that one is permitted to plow a field in which there are 10 saplings to every Beit Seah during the 30 days that precede a Shemitah year. We'll unpack that in a second. Arava, the willow ceremony that's carried out in the temple on Sukkot. V'nisuch ha-mayim, and the performance of the water libation service throughout the 7 days of Sukkot. Halacha le-Moshe mi-Sinai, were all ordained by the oral law transmitted to Moses at Sinai. So I end up not needing the workout of the verses if I accept this oral tradition, unbroken chain of tradition. And there are three areas that I have in this mentioning of what's Jewish law to Moses from Sinai. First one, Esther Nitiot. We know that every seventh year is a Shemitah year, right? You have to let your land lay fallow. There's a law also that 30 days before, I can't plow the field. But if I have 10 young saplings in an area the size of a seah.
Size of a what?
What's called a seah.
That's
it. It's a measurement. Mm-hmm. Then I can plow that up. And I can make sure that I'm doing what I need to do to make sure that soil is turned and that I'll ensure a decent future for my barley crop mostly. And other fruit that's growing there as a partner crop. Okay, so that's one law. Do I have a verse that says that? No. It's halacha l'moshe m'sinai. The next part. Willow. Arava. So the willow ceremony, as we see, the willows stood up against the side of the altar. The Temple Institute has pictures of these too. There are some willow practices in the temple that we don't even do in our time. And again, that seems like that was known by Moshe. And finally, Nisuch HaMayim in the temple and the libations of the water, this too was from Moses. Now, back to Bobby's question. Do we have anyone arguing that Aharon the priest was the core or the one to really understand what the Jewish law was all about? And the answer is no, we don't. We know that Moses was instructed to instruct the Kohanim. And everything goes back to Moses the instructor. Now, what's interesting about that question, though, about Moses being the instructor, is that you have a workout of what this principle really means within the Talmud itself and within rabbinic literature. And so, in order to really understand the depth of why it's on a page 3 that we're having the debate between how we prove a certain kind of practice in the temple, which, by the way, again, links to what we say in our Amidah, because we know we're giving some same space. We're giving space. We have a ritual about water as well. We have liturgy about rain. We have liturgies that recognize the same thing they were recognizing over here. We have to work out, what is this debate really all about, or what's the possibility? What do we have to understand about what they're really debating? And just interestingly, no, there's not a kind of, let's go talk to Aharon about it, or let's ask Aharon about it. Not that I know of as a popular theme, for sure, in the Gemara. They'll always go back to this Torah L'Moshe Mitzinah. So here is what I want to do to extend our daf tonight. I want to show you in rabbinic literature in a couple places where this principle, this doctrine, appears and how we are to understand it. Given that it's, I believe, as Professor Weiss-Livni and Dr. Hayes has pointed out, a real debate inside, that there's some debate about whether or not I need this kind of hermeneutic of versus proving versus just accepting it as tradition. And secondly, we should just know what they mean to say when they're saying that it was granted to Moses or taught to Moses on Sinai. Yeah?
That seems to be an assertion, and we can read any challenges. It seems to be an assertion that it's generally accepted that all these three rituals occurred in the temple. As the argument that this was one of three that were always done, and therefore was...
Well, the Shemitah one was not in the temple.
Oh, okay.
The Shemitah one was out there for every farmer,
right.
Even Am Haaretz, right? So, I hear you, but that one,
yeah, that one
makes it much more popular.
Essentially, it says this is the way it was always done, is really what I think.
I think you could go so far as to say in a colloquialism, this is the way it was done. You could go that far. But it's also saying it was very holy because it was attached to the Sinai experience. And it was done this way because God revealed it to Moses.
And how did Moses reveal it?
And then Moses, well, these are going to be some of the questions. If I told you now, just back up for a second, if I told you now the doctrine of Moses received the Torah on Sinai, what would your first thought be about what he received based on some of what you've learned in the past or you've heard in the past?
A flash disk.
What's that?
A flash drive.
Great. So we now have this way of understanding how so much information could be downloaded on some piece of technology. Okay.
The Ten Commandments and the Torah.
The Ten Commandments and the Torah itself.
Yeah.
Now, in your version of the Ten Commandments, were they, there are two stone tablets, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the movie.
Yeah, like the movie. I was going to say, does Charlton Heston play a role in this? Also the Torah. Do you mean the Torah as in Moses knows the entire Torah in his mind, or he actually has a scroll?
It was a little unclear.
It's a little unclear.
It's a little unclear, but
okay.
He knows it in his mind.
In his mind.
He knows it in his mind.
And oral law.
But we already knew that there was few chapters already written before he went up to the mountain.
Right.
How do we know that?
Well,
I don't remember who studied this about Gilulim.
Okay, you're gonna. Ron's making a reference to a Gemara. We're gonna see.
Also, to the extent of how, based on how you define Torah, when Moses came back, he knew the future.
Right. The future. Let's just keep capital T, capital F.
Yeah.
Right, you've heard that before when it comes to Moses being on Sinai.
I thought that the ark itself had a spot for something other than the tablets.
Okay, the ark itself is a container, so it's got to contain something else. We don't know what that something else is because it's not described.
Right, but there's, maybe I got this wrong because every time I read it I get confused, but it seemed to imply that separate from the tablets there was room for something else.
The broken tablets.
No, not...
That for sure, it says in the Torah you're going to put them in there.
Yeah.
In the Midrash.
But that there's a slot for something
else. Okay, so it appears almost, you know, or at least we understand from tradition that there's room for something else. I think that is a general understanding. Anybody else have a different take? So I want you to see the abundance of traditions about what it is that happened on Sinai to begin with. So that when we hear Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai, now it's going to get really expansive and it's going to like really, really give us a different sense of what they might mean. Because I'll tell you the truth, the way I read it and the way I was reading it, and then I was affirmed by the articles I read about this principle, this doctrine, we might not know exactly what they mean by this.
See, I've always felt that it was all oral.
All.
All of it was oral. And at some point, the written Torah was written down. I mean, it took a longer time for the oral law to get written down.
Okay. So all oral, at a certain time, gets written down?
And for me,
what's that certain time? Do you have a mind?
Ezra broke the Torah.
Oh, maybe Ezra?
Okay.
Let's look at the traditions.
So I just had a revelation, so to speak. So is it possible that God gave Moses these tablets and they were somewhat shorthand? He explained, you know, there was some discussion. And you know these are your sort of your crib notes, so you don't forget what this is about. These are the 10 sort of core ideas.
Right.
And now let me explain them to you. And then when he came down, or sometime later, he referred to these 10 sort of.
Yeah. You know what's the only problem with that theory that they are the chapter,
sure
the total
one.
Chapter headings, is that.
But I don't mean chapter headings. I mean just like an idea.
Well, right. But the dilemma there is if you say only the tablets are available, and then you have to flesh everything out, and he didn't get anything else, or didn't create any other kind of legislation, is that there's so much about the land, and there's so much about war, and there's so much about kings, and there's so you know that. Okay, so if he knows what's all here and the future. If there's room for something else, and Moses went up the mountain, and he's supposed to come back down with other things. If some were written before, and some are going to be written later. So wait a minute, how long? Let's go through and let's see what's in rabbinic text. This is a source sheet that I made for you that's on my Safari account. If I haven't done a heads up about my Safari account or what Safari is, let me just take a second to explain to you. Safaria.org is an online text library that we can use to build now source sheets just like this one. And I can collect the sources I want and create this kind of presentation. And they live online in my Safaria, Scott Bolton, or Safaria Rabbi Scott Bolton, and various source sheets will come up. And you'll see from past classes even, and when we were studying Tzedakah and Baba Batra, there's a bunch of different source sheets that I have in there from that year and other topics. And other colleagues and other, it's a community of users, and we can add texts, And sometimes people will look at a source sheet and say, oh, I think I have a great text for you to add to that one because I can't edit yours. You should, you know, add this to yours. And nice and generous Safari users are really helping one another create even deeper dimensionality of their source sheets in that community of practice kind of way.
You just go on? You don't need a password?
No, you don't need a password. You can create your own account. It's open to the public. As long as somebody shares it with the public, any source sheet that they've created is online.
So yours is Safari Scott Bolton?
So mine is, if you put Safari Scott Bolton, you'll see that I have a profile with lots of source sheets.
I think you do have to log in to see the source sheet.
Oh, yeah? Do you have to create a username?
I think so.
Okay, you might have to create.
I know you have to create one to make source sheets, but I think also to see them.
Uh-huh. So I don't know because I have one in use for a number of years.
But you didn't mention that it's a tremendous set of sources, the original sources.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It has an incredible amount of literature.
Yeah, you're right. I should mention that. It's a library.
Mm-hmm.
It's an online library, and it's expanding more and more. Sometimes I don't love the library because they have one version of a text versus another that's a version that seems not to be the same version that's in print over here. But that's just technical for users like me. And the other thing is oftentimes they won't have a translation yet of a text that we really need to have translated to have access to. So they're still working on it. It's a work in progress. But the Talmud is translated, for instance. The Tanakh is translated, for instance. The Mishnah is translated, for instance. And you can find all kinds of great...
But you can do it by topic if you want to.
You could also put in a search for a topic. And texts and source sheets will come up that you can link into. Okay. So let's look at the Torah, the doctrine of Torah Moshe Mi-Sinai. I'm starting here with this verse just as an example. In the Torah, you get verses like these. Ela chukim va-mishpatim va-torot asher natan Adonai. But I'm starting with this one because of the word torot. It's a plural of Torah. And it's in Vayikra. It's in Leviticus already. So these are the rules, the chukim, the mishpatim, the instructions, or case law, if some people even want to go, va-torot, and if you just wanted to translate it plainly, you would say the instructions. But the Midrash is going to take that word torot. It's going to see that that word is plural in terms of the word Torah, torot. And it's going to now make a limud. It's going to teach you something about what it is that Moses has in his possession or that we received. It says, Ela chukim ha-mishpatim ha-torot. Ha-chukim elu ha-midrashot. The chukim that are mentioned are not just statutes or laws. They are the midrashim themselves, the hermeneutical workouts that we do in order to understand what the law is in the Torah. When it says midrash, it doesn't mean the story midrash, generally. In this case, it's tied with a legal word, and therefore it's presenting this word in this verse from Vayikra as the word that gives you the legal workouts.
Like
midrash.
What we just read.
Okay. The Hamishpatim Elu Hadinim. And then these Mishpatim, these case laws are the dinim. We're going to learn a din. We're going to learn a law, having applied law from the Torah. We're going to learn what the law of any given case is. Vahatorot, Milamed Sheshtei Torot Nitnu Lehem Yisrael. Two Torahs were given to Israel. Echad Bichtav Vechad Baalpe. One is the quote-unquote written Torah, and one is the oral Torah. So if what's that?
It's written as
one Wharton. Yeah, I see. Okay, so you have the written Torah and the oral Torah. That is the traditional outlook, right? And if you wanted to say what the traditional outlook was in terms of Sinai already, you would say Moses has a written Torah, a la Bobby, what you were describing, and Moses received oral Torah, and that's given orally. That's an oral Torah until it's written down. Listen to Brachot. Brachot Hey, page 5. Amar Rabbi Levi Bar Chama, Amar Rabbi Shimon Ben Lakish. My dichtiv. What's written when it says ve'et nalchayet luchora even ve'hatorah b'hamitzvah asher katavti? What does it really say when I wrote? I'll give you the tablets of stone and the Torah and the mitzvah that I have written to teach them. Elu aseret adibrot. the tablets. These are the ten utterances. Torah, Zem Mikra. The Torah, this is the Chumash. These are the five books of Moses. HaMitzvah, this is the Mishnah that I have written. Asher Katavti. Elu, these are the prophets and the writings. Lahorotam, Ze Gemara Milamed, Shekulam Nidnu L'Moshe Misinai. So what did Moshe get, according to this? Two sets, or a set of tablets, which really becomes two sets. He gets the five books of Moses, which we think of as a Torah, if anybody was thinking of the scroll itself, right, and that it contains the five books of Moses. But what else did he get along with that? The Tanakh, the rest of what you need to make a Jewish Bible, the prophets and the writings, which if people have this in their mind, that he comes down with the Torah, wait a minute, where then are the writings and the prophets? Are they a separate scroll and there's space for them in the ark? Or does the first original stuff, you know, is it just longer than just the five books of Moses? Those are written. And then the Mishnah. The Mishnah's there. Doesn't say anything about the rest of the Talmud either. Do they mean by saying Mishnah that it's all the Talmud as well? It's presented as the text. This is the text in front of us.
It says the Gemara is to teach them. This is the Gemara, I think.
Ah, so far, I need a verb for that. But that doesn't sound physical.
No.
Right, I'm not there yet.
If the teaching of the Gemara, of the Mishnah, is the Gemara.
Okay, so good. So the teaching, it's just an oral tradition, is the point.
Yeah.
Right? Until the time that what? I want to actually commit that to writing, and I don't have to do that until later. So obviously, what's the oral part of this passage?
The oral part is the Gemara.
Is the Gemara.
Yeah.
Is the oral part the Mishnah?
No.
I
think it is. Yeah.
No. So in this one, I've now mixed up a little bit what my oral part is and what my written part is. If I say Asher Katavti, if I really say that I wrote these things down and I included the Mishnah there, but the oral part was the Gemara. Listen to the Shmot Rabbah. This is a midrash on Exodus, Rabbinic era. Devar Acher. Shnei Luchot Haidu. On their two tablets. What is the two tablets? Corresponding to heaven and earth. Corresponding to groom and bride. Corresponding to the two Shoshvinim, agents or groomsmen. Corresponding to this world and the world to come. Shnei Luchot Haidut, Rabbi Hanina said, it is written as if it were vocalized Luchat, an apparently singular form, neither of them bigger than the other. So I do have some sense that they are physical and that they correspond to symbolic meaning. Why do I need two tablets if I'm going to have the same text over here in the scroll? Because those tablets have symbolic meaning for me. What's the Midrash really saying about what text is? Potentially it's saying in the ancient world, I need to have stones and I need to have symbolic stones, right? We know this from the ancient world that people like to write things on stela, on stones. They like to have things on walls. They like to have carvings. Here, the way we do it is we have an ark. We keep stones within the ark. We have a text of sorts that is really a symbolic text, not all the Torah. Back to your point, Aaron, I think this midrash is making evident that, no, that wasn't really like the first text and then there's the rest of it, or that the rest of it is interpreting this. But here we have this set of tablets that are symbolic as well. And what are they symbolizing? The meeting of heaven and earth. And the groom and the bride in this case being what? God and
the Jewish
people. And so you need to have text that is symbolic text. That's what we mean. Moshe l'Sinai, you know, from Sinai l'Moshe, it means that there's going to be some symbolic text, and there's going to be this other text. And what's the other text? All those ones we read about in Brachot. And now go and say and look at Gittin 60 on page 2.
Just say this dualism, though, almost has a Greek feel to it. You know, the humors emerge from the hot, cold, moist, dry, and the elements, the fire, and so with this structuring it in a dualism, so I'm just wondering, is there by this time a Greek influence here, or is this...
See, I think it's a little... I hear you about the dualism. I think what's happening here, though there is all kinds of loan words from the Greek, and there's an encounter with Beit Philosoph, there's Greek philosophy, they know that, and this kind of thing. I think over here, it's about some of the initial thoughts about how to explain the sanctity of text and the different kinds of quote-unquote texts that are the traditional ones we see Moses bringing down the mountain. And that the reason why he needs the tablets of the law, or the possibility for what they symbolize, and since we know he also brought us this whole Torah, which the canon's coming into total, if not finalization, definitely crystallization on a workshop level, editorial nature, we have an understanding that he came down with a whole longer Torah, books of Moses, Tanakh, and he has these Shnei Luchot HaBri. So what are those? What do they symbolize as texts? And so I don't know that there's the dualism might be if one power in the first tablet was battling the second tablet for primacy or something like this. That to me would speak of dualism in the way that we see Zoroastrian influence even more than Greek in the ancient world. But here we have more of a meeting of the vertical Am Yisrael and God, and the possibility for communication of God's will. And it actually is the core of rabbinic thinking to get to the notion that we are really inheritors of a tradition where there was a communication by God of God's will on Sinai.
I got it all. I was just wondering about the way it's presented in this way, whether that's derived from the way in which these dualisms and Greek understanding of the world. I mean, that was the whole issue was, and that's why the humors get out there, and the world is upset when the humors are out of balance, because these dualisms are intentions. So here it's a literary use, obviously, in a Jewish context. But I just wonder if the mindset of thinking about things in this way wasn't influenced.
It's a two-ness that goes through this, because you're doing two tablets, so that there is this looking at things that are either paired or in opposition, but the number two is kind of the leitmotif of the way that...
Okay, so I can see where you're coming. By way of the humors, there's another text that I'll show you in a moment that I thought of being more in connection with some of the philosophical thinking about where from understandings of wisdom in the world stems, and that it is yet connected to God, yet mediated through humors, mediated through elements. So that's to come.
Who knew how to read?
That's a great question by way of what we're thinking about when we talk about text.
What did you say?
Who knew how to read?
So we definitely believe that already for, if not centuries, millennia, the priestly class had that ability. We read in several of the passages, and say for Shmuel, for instance, the book of Samuel, that Kohanim are there to teach. In the book of Ezra, the Kohanim were the ones to gather the people when the second temple is being restored, or Jerusalem is being restored as a city and the temple is about to be. They have a public Torah reading, and then they break out even in small group format. I would say it's really pretty contemporary by way of focus group or conference best practices, and they say, okay, we read it to you in public, now go study in small group format. And they have priests, and they have certain Levites, and they have certain people take groups, and they go and they literally review the text. So what does that say about people's desire for relating to text, if they weren't literate in reading it themselves, that they actually had some sense that that was a central feature of authority in the life of community, that text played a role, and that they wanted to relate to this text to create a certain culture and attachment to their God as a larger society, if we want to learn from this Ezra text, which is the end of the Tanakh, if you will. Fast forward to the rabbinic era, for sure the rabbis read, but that's on the heels of a movement called the Sofarim, which has at its core Samech Fei Resh, Sefer book, and we know from having found extant libraries in commoners' houses on an archaeological level that more than just the rabbinic higher class had access to language possibility and reading possibility. And now, that might not have been the language of Torah per se or Midrash Halakha. They might have had a translation in a vernacular language of their time of a book that got canonized. And by the way, their version is a little different over here in the Greek than we have over here. But why do we know that it had to be legislated about what you do with these books and the fact that it was a little bit more widespread? We know from the Gemara we learned in chapter 16 of Shabbat, where that source is also included, by the way, in the sources for study on 270 through 272 for those of us who come to Friday night services. And the Kol Kivei HaKodesh Matzilino Tamidnei HaDleika. We save texts in our libraries, these texts and not those texts, from the fire that breaks out in our home on the Sabbath. So we do have some sense that there is a literate group, and that especially in this age, they're becoming more literate because they're going to afternoon drashot by the rabbis, and they're relating to text in a deeper way, and the rabbis are trying to encourage us to spend time on the afternoon in the house of reading, in the Beit Midrash, in the house of learning and study, and that the Mishnah relates to it in such a popular way. Widespread? No telling in terms of literacy how widespread it was, how limited it was, but that's a great question to keep in mind. And the final point I'll make on it, and then Ari, I'll take your question or your comment. The oral culture is really the raison d'etre. I mean, the orality and passing along stories and law and text in a very significant way happens because you have people who memorize what sages say and are able to recite them and report them. So Moses, if we're going to say what's most likely, was he a written text guy or was he an oral keeper of story and law? I would say one of the great revolutions, right? I would say one of the great revolutions that we see here from a Torah perspective, even if we don't want to go towards the Egypt and he was educated in Egypt perspective.
And he was educated in Egypt.
This was a different kind of text than Egyptian text per se, but yes, I mean, if we wanted to say that he was somehow schooled in scribal arts from that time, we can say that to bring text and to write text on plastered stones as they cross the Jordan River, remember that we have to paint the text and set up the stones, that at least he's the one centering us in what is a written tradition. And so that Moses receives the Torah Shebichtav, just to come back to our learning, on the textual level, that Moses receives it or is the one to create the tablets or to receive the tablets and then translate the tablets is in that sense potentially a written text revolution of sorts for this group of wandering Jews. Ari.
I'm a little confused. When Yehuda Nasi collated all the oral history and they started...
Puts together the Mishnah. 200 CE.
So the assumption is that it was written down different parts of the era beforehand. There was some sort of written history, because otherwise it was all oral. So
well,
we didn't have any writings.
Yeah, I would say that since we know that we have extant text in the Midrashic, definitely in the layers of Midrash from before 200 CE, for sure there's written text circulating. And we don't know that it was only at 200 CE. That's a good... You know, it's a good way to tell the story, that at 200 CE they gathered there and they wrote it all down from people who had memorized it orally. But there's a textual productivity within the ancient world that we know about, and that's been affirmed in deeper ways by the great findings that we have from the Dead Sea Scrolls Library, right? As we talk about what fragments we have and what scrolls exist and are and can be looked at as proto-rabbinic kind of codes, we don't necessarily have that rabbinic library at Yavne the same way we have a Dead Sea Scroll Library over here, but we know that, that there was some text around. Is a lot of it oral? Are there mitargamines? Are there targamons? Are there translators of sages' teachings orally in the Beit Midrash and then in the Great Gathering that Yehuda Nasi has? Yes. So oral culture is still, it's not in decline, but written culture is definitely present.
You and I have talked about this before. That one of my favorite quotes from Senth and Raphael Hirsch is that the written Torah are the lecture notes, but there was much more to the lecture than was written down in the notes.
Right. He does make that point, and he likes to say, though, that the two are inextricably connected, and that you can't have written Torah and what Torah says without the oral Torah that was always a partner to it at the same time, though, and that the lecture notes kind of were given all to Moses on Sinai is where he falls.
Mm-hmm.
But let's see if everything was said at Sinai, according to these sources in our hand, or they were revealed over some time and what that time was, because I want to do a little bit more text before we go. Look at Giti. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Bina. So the Gemara discusses the previously mentioned dispute, and Rabbi Yochanan says in the name of Rabbi Bina, Torah, Imran, you referred to this, Megillah, Megillah, Nitna. Torah was given at the outset, scroll by scroll. As it stated, Shenemar, Asmati hine bati b'megillat sefer, katuv alai, and as it says, I come with the scroll of the book that is written for me. Rashi says, on that point, Kshenemra parshal Moshe, when a certain section was said to Moses, Hayak tuva, it was then written, Uluvasof mem shana, and at the end of 40 years, Kashen Nigmaru Kola Parshiot, when at the end of 40 years, all of them were written down, they were tied together, stitched together, and sewn together. I'm on page 2 at Gittin 68. For those looking. I'm reading in the Hebrew on the right-hand side of Gittin 68.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the left-hand side is
right-hand
side. I'm sorry. See this?
I see Rashi over here,
yeah.
But I don't see it on it translated.
Rashi is not translated.
Oh.
Sorry. Sorry. I was at work. I was at work.
For some of us.
Sorry.
High expectations.
Okay, so you tell us what Rashi
said. So let me do Rashi again, because Rashi is important, and I couldn't get to translating everything today. Rashi says, Kshenemra parsha l'Moshe, when a parsha of the Torah was said to Moses, Hayak tuva, it was then written down. Ulevasof mem shana, and at the end of 40 years, kashenigmaru kol parshiot, when all of the sections of the Torah were spoken and written, chibran, he put them together, begidin with that sinu, and vetafran, and he sewed it all together. So how many years?
40 days. It was 40 years during when they were in the desert.
Exactly. Mem shana. Now, is there a version of the text that says mem yom?
Probably.
I went on a search. I could not find one. Because I was convinced I'd find one text, at least that Rashi had, or a Gemara, that had mem yom. But I can't find it yet. So stand by. I'm going to still look.
Isn't that the time at which we celebrate our holidays, or between the 40 days, right?
No, well, we say traditionally 49. That there were 40 days and then there were another 40 days and the Torah is given on Yom Kippur, right?
Right.
Oh, but wait a minute. So why does this make better sense? Let's end here for tonight. Why does it make better sense? If Moses gets the whole Torah on Sinai, right? And God says, go over there and speak to the rock. And Moses goes, hold on. I'm not doing that. Right? And he goes back and he says, wait a minute. So this makes sense. This makes sense. As the reality unfolds and God is communicating with Moses on Sinai, and God is communicating with Moses and Aaron, and God is leading the people with cloud of clouds, and then telling Moses what exactly needs to be in the Torah, because we have verses that say God spoke to him from the Ohel Moed, from the Tent of Meeting. God spoke to him in the Mishkan. God spoke to him in the desert. And then I'm going to get to more texts, and we'll get back to Barry's point about the Greek influence, and perhaps maybe the next text is going to be a little bit connected with some of this, the way we are communicating with God and through these humors, and wisdom comes. But if I had it all to begin with, I would never have had the true experience of what the Midbar is all about for 40 years. And so when we think of, and I think classically we do think of Moses going up and coming down, at least with this scroll that's all the Torah, right? Or at least it's all here. This text upends that theory and says, no, it was an ongoing revelation, and that Sinai, if you will, was the beginning of a revelation journey. And that at the end of 40 years, he's able to write it. Now, did he write in every last part? I leave you with that thought, that question. What's in the Torah? How hard that would be if he had to write everything himself. And wow, he didn't get to look ahead. He didn't have it all at Sinai. And that's the only reason how we could have the stories of the truths of the Midbar, of the desert experience. Good. And who was the keeper then, and who didn't allow for turning the page? Right, it's when your teacher tells you, if you read ahead and know the answer, it's not going to work, so do not read ahead.
It's very clear, he wanted to get the whole thing. God said, take two tablets and see me in the morning.